The National Catholic Register is the essential and reliable source of news and views for Catholics. Subscribe today. Go to EWTN.com and click on the link for The Register or call 800-421-3230.
From the National Catholic Register, this is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
This week on Register Radio, Tim Drake talks with National Catholic Register correspondent Gerald Russello about his recent article titled, and get this title, Would Obama's Mandate Fly with the Founding Fathers? In our second half, Register Executive Director Dan Burke is here. He will turn the tables on Tim and talk about the new blog that Tim wrote titled Vatican Attacked, about the hacktivist group Anonymous and their recent takedown of the Vatican website. Welcome again to Register Radio. It's a co-production of EWTN and the National Catholic Register. I'm Tom Price, along with Tim Drake, senior writer for The Register. Hello, Tim.
It is always great to be with you, Tom.
The pleasure is mine, my friend. Also with Dan Burke, executive director for The Register.
It's great to be with you, Tom.
Let us begin with Tim this time. You know, it seems like everybody is talking about the mandate these days, but it might be a good idea to take the longer view and go all the way back to the founding of America, since religious liberty is one of the cornerstones of our country, Tim.
Yeah, that's right, Tom. A historical view, I think, is a good thing for us to get some perspective on the issue. Practicing attorney and journalist Gerald Russello is editor of Christianity and European Culture, Selections from the Work of Christopher Dawson, and he runs the online book review, The University Bookman. He's written frequently for the National Catholic Register, and one of his most recent articles is Would Obama's Mandate Fly with the Founding Fathers? And it's what we'll be talking with him about today. Gerald, thanks for joining us on Register Radio today.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, Gerald, why don't you give us a brief history lesson? What were the Founding Fathers doing when they drafted the Constitution, the Bill of Rights for this great country that we call home?
Well, they were doing a number of things. They obviously wanted to enact a governmental structure so that the national government could coordinate the activities of a number of states and deal with Britain and the ending of the Revolution and some practical governmental matters. But they also wanted to make sure that, as the Declaration of Independence says, that the reason for government was to secure rights that already existed, that people had bestowed on them just by their natural existence as human beings from their creator. And so the founders wanted to make very clear that the governmental structure was not designed to create rights or to limit rights, but to protect the rights that already existed just from the fact of people gathering in society.
What do you think would be the Founding Fathers' reactions to something like the recent Health and Human Services mandate? I mean, is this what the Founding Fathers intended?
I would say absolutely not. And I think they'd have a couple of different reactions. I think first, as one of the commenters to the piece that I wrote stated, and I think this is right, I don't think that the founders would have thought, quote, health care to be a right at all that needed protection or coercion by the government to enforce in some way. So I think that even the ability of the government to do things like mandate types of insurance coverage would really be far beyond the imagination of the founders to require. Secondly, I think that the people like Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, even though they were not necessarily certainly friendly to the church and had their own perhaps idiosyncratic religious views, I think could fairly be said to hold as a core belief that religious exercise of your faith was at the core of what it meant to be a person, and that the state could not force people to act or to allow others to act or to help others to act contrary to their faith. And so I think that this mandate very clearly requires religious institutions to act in ways that are contrary to their faith, and I don't think that the founders would have thought that this was an appropriate use of the power of government. And then thirdly, I think that drawing on some recent work that a Catholic scholar named Robert Vischer has done, I think that the founders would have been perplexed by the use of government as a participant in determining which kinds of insurance coverage has, rather than, as I said before, just an entity that is there to secure rights. What we've done recently is shift the debate between someone saying, I have a right to do X, and therefore no one can infringe upon it, to I have a right to do X, and therefore I can use the government to force others to grant that right to me. And that's exactly what's happening in the HHS mandate. People are using the government to force others to act to satisfy what they consider their own rights. That's exactly the opposite of the constitutional structure and the way the Declaration is written.
That's fascinating. I want to remind listeners, we are you're listening to Register Radio, and I'm speaking with Gerald Russello, practicing attorney and journalist and author of a recent article in the Register called Would Obama's Mandate Fly with the Founding Fathers? The mandate, I mean, it really does go specifically against against the Bill of Rights in that what you're describing, it's forcing people to do something that goes against their very beliefs, doesn't it?
That's exactly right. And I quote in the Register article a piece that Jefferson wrote in 1777 that he wrote in part to further the disestablishment of the Anglican Church, but its principle applies exactly here. He felt that to compel a man to furnish contributions of money for the propagation of opinions which he disbelieves and abhors is sinful and tyrannical. And that's and here the HHS mandate is going even further. It's not just fostering, forcing people to pay for the propagation of opinions, but actual actions. And unfortunately, this is of a piece, this HHS mandate is of a piece with other state laws that have been sort of burbling up over the last few years that use the language of rights and of health care and of equality to disguise the fact that what they're really doing is infringing on religious liberty in the name of a secular value. Now, it's not to say that there is anything necessarily wrong with certain secular values, equality. I think we all would value that in America. Certainly, the bishops have spoken about certain standards of health care and subsistence that are required. But this is something a little bit different. This is using those words to somehow denigrate and reduce the status of religious liberty. And that really is something that not only is contrary to the Bill of Rights, but really is contrary to the way Catholics understand religious liberty, which is the right of each individual to seek God and to seek the truth and to exercise that right in the way that they see fit.
You know, it strikes something that I thought about often, which is that we've really come to a time in our culture where we are talking always about our rights to do this and our rights to do that. And there seems to be a difference between, you know, a right to health care, and we can argue over whether or not that, you know, is a right, versus the sorts of rights that that we all have, which are life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think I would agree with you that there are certain, shall we call them more practical or down-to-earth rights that one may have, the right to health care, the right perhaps to educate your children in the way that you see fit, obviously your right to life. And I think that our, unfortunately in America, our language doesn't really distinguish among those two. So someone may have a right to contraception in their insurance plans, and that is somehow treated as equivalent to rights that are in the Constitution, rights that are enunciated in the Declaration of Independence. And unfortunately, we don't have a really good way to distinguish those between rights that cannot be infringed upon, that I exercise just as a right of my existence as a human person, and those rights that really require some practical application and some prudential application of things like costs and efficacy and whether or not they infringe on other more fundamental rights. I think we'd all agree that in a nation with perfect health care but you were forbidden to worship would not be a nation where rights were respected in a way that we understand it. And so even in a place like China or Soviet Russia, where lots of rights were enunciated and supposedly protected, but as a matter of fact, the most basic rights of people were infringed, we would not consider those free nations. And I think in our country, we are beginning to lose that distinction between things that are so fundamental because they exist outside of any government, and governments merely recognize and secure them, and rights that really are able to be affected once we are in political society that are subject to prudence and subject to restrictions and limitations.
I want to remind listeners, you're listening to Register Radio, and we are speaking with Register correspondent Gerald Russello. It is safe to say, though, isn't it, Gerald, that our nation's founding was Protestant or Protestant in more ways than one, wasn't it?
That's right. That's right. And I think that one piece that's lost when we talk about the founding is we tend to look at the 55 or 60 or so people who were at Philadelphia in that hot summer signing the Declaration and writing the Constitution in 1787, in 1776, obviously. And the larger country that then had to ratify that Constitution. And those communities who were actually sitting there reading the newspapers, debating whether or not to join this new nation, were really small communities of dissenting Protestants. And, you know, as I wrote in the piece, there was hardly a significant Catholic presence at all. And indeed, some of the founders, such as I think the lone Catholic, Charles Carroll, was penalized for his faith early in his career. That was the nation. It was a nation of deeply religious local communities that, if nothing else, believed that that their ability to live according to their faith was the reason why they had come here and was the reason why separation with Britain might have been necessary and was the reason why they believed local self-government was so important. It was not a generic deist or Unitarian type society at all. It was a deeply religious one, and one where if you felt that you needed to act out your faith in a particular way, you would go and form your own community and be left alone.
We down to our end here. We just had a couple minutes left, and I want to ask you, Gerald, how do you interpret this in a larger way? I mean, do you see this simply as the beginning of a gradual or perhaps not so gradual erosion of our rights as people of faith?
I do, unfortunately, and the Register has been kind enough to let me publish a number of things over the last couple of years showing how in a number of different contexts at the state level and at the national level, there's really nothing less than a direct assault on religion in general and really the church in particular, since the church is in many ways the largest participant in many of these public debates. And in certain state legislatures, for example, it's been quite clear that the passage of these laws is meant to exclude and throw out the church from the public square. And so I think that this is just the beginning of a much larger fight that will be much more direct and much more aggressive. And you know, the fortunate thing, I think it was St. Augustine that said, good comes out even of evil. It's nice to see that the bishops have recognized this and have really united across whatever other differences they may have in recognition of this threat. I mean, this is almost a classic pagan Rome situation where there is a state that is aggressively opposed to the church and is using the weapons at its disposal, legislation, rights language, the fondness we all have for the level of health care in this country, really to attack the church.
Hey, Gerald, this is Dan Burke. One just quick question before we exit. It seems to me Dennis Prager had a great phrase. He's a well-known national radio talk show host that he uses, and he says that the bigger the government, the smaller the people. And it sure seems that the size of the federal government in particular, it just continues to expand and threatens the rights of all people, not just those of religious faith. Do you see that trend? And it seems specifically counter to the Founding Fathers' intent.
Oh, that's Dennis has it exactly right. The larger the government gets in the sense just of size and expense and the kinds of activities it feels it is most uniquely situated to address, like healthcare, like education, like family life, the smaller the people get in the sense that the less circle of action they have, the less opportunity they have to form communities, to form institutions, to live the way they want to live. And what that does, and if I can harken back to Dawson, the historian I've written about, what that does is really an expression of the state's hostility to any source of authority other than itself. And it can't really abide the church or another religious institution saying, we have a way of how to live that is not yours. And what we're seeing here is, unfortunately, an erosion of the Republican, small r, self-government model that allowed local communities to live the way they wanted with more of a big government model that tells you what's good for you.
Tom Price here again, Gerald. I guess if I was going to put a button on all this, it would be if you're going to do some home renovations, you really don't want to mess with the foundation, right?
That's exactly right.
Well, Well, I really want to thank you. And again, we will steer people to ncregister.com for your excellent article, Would Obama's Mandate Fly with the Founding Fathers? It's really, really good food for thought. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
When we return, Dan and Tim will be talking about computers and the people who cause trouble with them. Unfortunately, this time around, their target was the Vatican. This is Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Stay with us.
Are you concerned about the way our nation and our world are heading? Are you looking for the truth behind the issues of the day? Do you need support in standing up for life, the family, and our Catholic faith? Then join well-informed Catholics worldwide who depend on the National Catholic Register to address the most compelling questions of our time. Now part of the EWTN family of services, the Register is a trusted source of news and views with an unwavering fidelity to the Pope and the Magisterium. Get the in-depth analysis you need explaining what happened and why it matters for Catholics who engage in the culture to serve Christ. To start your subscription to the National Catholic Register today, go to EWTN.com and click on the banner for the Register, or call 800-854-6316. That's EWTN.com and click on the Register subscription banner, or call 800-854-6316.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
And welcome back. Along with Tim Drake and Dan Burke, I'm Tom Price. You know, Dan, when we put together our EWTN radio news links every day, we go to a variety of sources. We pull in Joan Lewis, our own EWTN Rome Bureau Chief. We look to Teresa Tomeo, and we look to Annie Mitchell from the Sunrise Morning Show. A lot of it we put together here. And obviously, the Vatican is one of our primary news sources. But this you know, not too long ago, we had a lot of trouble getting through to the Vatican.
You weren't the only one,
yeah.
Tom. Tim, the Internet is an amazing tool. Just, I think, 10 years ago, if you looked at the Register's influence alone, we're going to be limited to, at that time, our print circulation. But last year, over the year, we reached millions and millions of people through the web. And the Vatican certainly does that on a scale that far exceeds what we've done. But the downside of that is that somebody can work their way into the system. They're called hackers. And they can bring that single source down and cut that same information of spreading the gospel throughout the world. They can cut that information off and keep it from us, can't they?
Yeah, they can. And we have an example of that. It's happened three times now in recent months. There's a loose group of hackers known as Anonymous, and they have sought to bring down the Vatican website. Their first attempt to do this was actually unsuccessful, and they did this back in August while World Youth Day was taking place in Spain. They basically were able to pull together 1,000 different people from around the world. I believe it started in South America, Mexico, and then spread around the world. And for about a period of 25 days, they used an attack software to try to bring down the World Youth Day website, the registration site, but they were unsuccessful. But then more recently, on March 7th, one day after the arrest of six of their members from Britain, Ireland, Turkey, and the U.S., they were successful in taking down some Vatican web pages for several hours. Kind of to say, you know, you can cut off the head, but the body is going to remain alive. And which, interestingly, corresponds to their logo, which is a headless body. And what's interesting about it is you were talking about the inability to reach the site. And I myself, as a Catholic journalist, was trying to reach the site to post some links to some Vatican documents, and I was unable to. Of course, I didn't know that a cyber attack was going on at the time. And then a repeat attack took place just earlier this week, actually on March 12th, and the hackers were able to access the Vatican radio database. So it's kind of an alarming thing that this group is doing.
You know, both of you, I'll just throw this out here. It's hard for me to understand that kind of malicious mischief that would cause somebody to do this kind of damage. Certainly not to not just to the Vatican, but to any company or individual organization. All I can think of in this particular case is a phrase that we have in our family: "The light hurts their eyes."
That's an interesting thought, Tom. I think that at least in the first attack in August of 2011, they called it Operation Pharisee, and they were complaining against. At least they said their motives were sexual abuse in the church, the practice of confession, doctrine of liturgies and precepts of the church, their stance against abortion, contraceptive, that sort of thing. Tim covers this very well in his article, Vatican Attacked, on ncregister.com. So, Tim, do you believe that what Tom mentioned, is it that we're shining a light on the truth and that they're responding to that, or do you think this is just more of an excuse they use and this is just part of their fun?
I don't know. That's a very good question, and there does seem to be some confusion as to sort of the real motive for the attacks. Some of the anonymous hackers have said they're attacking the Vatican because of what they perceive as corruption in the Roman Catholic Church. But then, I mean, as evidence of their attack on March 7th, it seems to be kind of saying, hey, look at what we can do. You've arrested some of our members, but we're still able to get into, you know, this enormous institution's website. But if you take a look at the reasons that the individuals have given for why they are attacking the Vatican, they said that they're attacking it because of the doctrines, liturgies, and precepts of the church. They're attacking it because of the church's stand against abortion and contraceptives. They're attacking it because of the practice of the sacrament of confession. And they've described the Vatican as, quote, retrograde. And so, you know, I think there's more to this than just, hey, let's have some fun and try to see what sites we can take down.
This is Dan Burke, and I'm with Tim Drake for Register Radio. And we're talking about the recent attack on the Vatican, taking down the website. You know, Tim, you could blame this on the Protestants that are hostile, but you've done a little research on YouTube and found some interesting things about the motives behind some of this activity, and it just doesn't seem to be consistent. Their logo, as you mentioned, is a headless man. It seems that they don't really have any clear direction, do they?
Well, no, and if you actually look at what their slogan is, at least for those of us who are people of faith, you would find one aspect of their slogan rather alarming, and that is they say, "We are anonymous, we are legion. We do not forget, we do not forgive." That's basically the slogan of this group.
That doesn't reflect a Protestant sensibility with respect to how they see Christ. We both agree that he came to bring forgiveness and to redeem us, and if they're saying we don't forgive, we don't we don't forget, that's not really an accurate depiction of a Protestant mentality, at least not a small O Orthodox Protestant mentality. Do you agree with that?
No, I would agree with that. And, you know, our government has identified this group as a global cyber terrorist network. So they've attacked large banks, they've attacked Sony, they've attacked government agencies, the White House, FBI. So, you know, they, like you said, it just seems to be almost a rejection of any kind of authority, if you will.
Yeah, when you see radically mixed messages from groups like this, you really begin to suspect an intellectual chaos that's sort of a mask for an anarchistic Robin Hood mentality, that anything big is bad and oppressive, and of course, whatever I think is good and should be imposed on everyone else as well, which is kind of an ironic element to all of this.
Yeah, and that reminds me of an op-ed. It was actually the editorial written by the Minneapolis Star Tribune editorial staff just a few years ago. And in that editorial, they said that they were sort of within their rights to attack and take on the church because they didn't see it as different than any other large corporation. and that as a large corporation, it couldn't always be trusted. And, you know, and that's sort of what I see at work here.
Yeah, it's interesting. Having a bit of a technology background, I do want to go back to the idea that Tom presented, which is that because we are shining a light, we are going to be experience greater attack because we witness for Christ. Mm-hmm. Matthew chapter 5, Jesus said, "Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs will be theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when men revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil falsely on my account." And really, with the Vatican and many other institutions who bring the gospel, there is a constant attack. It's almost as if you can imagine your own home where there were 1,000 people trying to break in, and they're knocking and trying to find cracks and holes and ways and windows that are open and doors that are open. And in this case, there's probably millions who really don't understand the church, don't understand Christ, and reject him for the things that they don't understand, and are constantly looking to tear down something that asks something of them, that lifts up a higher standard of living in life, and that is subjecting our heart and mind to God and his kingdom.
That's right. I draw attention in my piece to a quote by that great British journalist and Catholic convert, G.K. Chesterton, in his book, The Thing, and he says very much the same. In referring to the church as, quote, the thing, he says, "All roads lead to Rome." And he says, "The thing is pursued age after age by an unreasonable hatred that is perpetually changing its reason. It led me at last to the only logical answer, which every fact of life now confirms, that the thing is hated as nothing else is hated, simply because it is, in the exact sense of the popular phrase, like nothing on earth."
Wow.
I thought that was a pretty compelling statement, which, you know, addresses exactly what you were talking about, Dan.
Sure, sure. And it certainly is compelling, as is your recent blog post, Vatican Attacked. And that's where we want to send people to check this out, ncregister.com. And Tim, as always, thank you so much for your depth and your insight on all this.
Yeah, thank you.
And Dan, thank you. And thank you, everyone, for joining us this week on Register Radio. For Tim Drake, Dan Burke, and all of us at The Register and here at EWTN, I'm Tom Price. See you next week.
For more information about the National Catholic Register and about Register Radio, go to ncregister.com. Podcasts of Register Radio are posted on ncregister.com and on ewtn.com. Join us next week at this time for Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
With your donations to the National Catholic Register, you will play an active role in clarifying the Church's views. Visit ncregister.com and click on the Donate tab, or call 205-568-9756.